weighing 230 pounds at 5'9". It was a much-improved 209-pound Ray Cronice who now sat with a spreadsheet in front of him and his eyes on the paused television. He still had more than 30 pounds to lose, but at his current rate, a respectable one, it would take at least 18 to 24 weeks. The spreadsheet was designed to fix this by comparing column after column of all the human activities he could isolate, each correlated to its caloric expenditure per hour for his weight. He was tired of being fat and hoped the numbers would provide a faster solution. Instead, they painted a futile picture. Even if he ran a marathon, 26.2 miles, he would only burn around 2,600 calories, or approximately 3/4 of a pound of fat. How could Phelps eat an extra 9,000 calories per day? He scanned his finger through the columns, jotted down a few notes, and defaulted to the calculator. It made no sense. In order for Phelps to burn those kinds of calories above and beyond what his resting metabolic rate, RMR, was, Ray recalls, keeping in mind that I had the calculations in front of me, and it's about 860 calories an hour at competitive swimming rates, he would have to sustain more than 10 hours of continuous butterfly every day. Not even he can do that. So what was going on? Was Phelps misinforming journalists during his Olympic quest? Sabotaging competitors foolish enough to mimic him based on an interview? The physics didn't work. Then, in an instant, paused over the spreadsheet after 15 years of frustration, it all became crystal clear. It was the thermal load of the water. Water is 24 times more thermally conductive than air. Phelps spends 3 or 4 hours a day in the water. The effect was the same as pouring hot coffee into a metal cup instead of a ceramic mug. The former loses calories, heat, much faster. Ray did the math with this new variable, and amazingly, it seemed to add up. In the 6 weeks that followed, from the weekend of October 27th to December 5th, he would lose 28.6 pounds of fat and never regain them. The game had changed. It seemed too good to be true, so, as a good scientist would, Ray tried to disprove himself. In the studies and science he reviewed, what struck him most was not evidence that contradicted his conclusions, but rather the near-complete omission of heat as a factor in fat loss. The common equation in the literature was simple. Weight loss, or gain, equals calories in minus calories out. This wasn't the problem. The problem was that every table for calories out, caloric expenditure, immediately fixated on activity level. It wasn't that the laws of thermodynamics were wrong. It was that the laws weren't properly represented when applied to the human body. Thermodynamics had somehow been robbed of heat. In Ray's world of space shuttles and atmospheric re-entry, heat was king. The laws of thermodynamics were being cited by people who didn't understand them. Take the first law of thermodynamics as an example. In simple terms, energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It can only change forms. The misquoters were limiting the ways ingested calories could change forms. They treated exercise and storage as the only two options. In fact, the human body is an open thermodynamic system and has a number of options beyond those. Ray's then 209-pound meat frame could exchange energy with his environment in the form of work, exercise, heat, or matter, excretion. Running a marathon of 26.2 miles might burn 2,600 calories. Working out in an 82-degree Fahrenheit pool for 4 hours could burn up to an extra 4,000 calories, if one considered thermal load. How else could people like Scott Parazynski, a friend of Ray's, eat can after can of Spam and other high-fat foods? Scott was an MD and former astronaut and had attempted to summit Everest twice, losing about 25 pounds on each attempt. He was successful on his second ascent. His troop ate lard and sticks of butter to prevent excessive weight loss. The workload of the climb alone could not account for the caloric expenditure, a 5,000-calorie deficit. It was the cold. Lots of cold. So Ray began to treat himself like a human space heater. He tried everything. He drank a gallon of ice water between waking and 11 a.m. He slept with no covers. He took midwinter shiver walks of 20 to 30 minutes with nothing but a t-shirt, earmuffs, and gloves on his upper body. He later found less painful options, but the results were undeniable. He lost almost 6 pounds in the first week. This was not the first time Ray had tried to lose weight. In 2006, he lost a respectable 20 pounds following the Body for Life, BFL, exercise and diet plan, designed by Bill Phillips. BFL performed as advertised, and Ray lost 17.8 pounds of fat in 12 weeks for an average weekly fat loss of 1.48 pounds. This was, by all conventional measures, a huge success. Unfortunately, in a pattern familiar to millions, he then gained it all back plus interest. In the second experiment, however, repeating BFL with intermittent cold exposure, Ray lost 28.6 pounds in 6 weeks for an average weekly fat loss of 4.77 pounds. The addition of cold exposure alone increased fat loss per week more than 3 times. This added up to 61% more total fat lost in 50% of the time. I found Ray's results both incredible and believable, but something was missing. First of all, he had also gained more muscle with cold exposure. Losing more heat couldn't account for that, though the muscle gain could have been accounted for by the slight inaccuracies of home-use calipers, plus or minus 2 pounds. I suspected there might be more to the story. Second, looking at the research, the math didn't seem to add up quite as neatly as I'd hoped. It's been shown that you can burn almost 4 times more fat than usual with 2 hours of cold exposure. 176.5 milligrams per minute instead of 46.9 milligrams per minute. This is great, but remember how deceptive percentage changes can be. If there are 9 calories in 1 gram of fat, and assuming the effect lasts for the time you're in the water, then this exposure would burn an extra 139 calories, 16 or 15.5 grams of fat. 15.5 grams? That's about 11 paper clips for 2 hours of torture. Ray was losing more than 3 additional pounds, approximately 1,350 grams of fat per week with cold exposures. To achieve that with water immersion alone, looking at the same studies, he'd need to spend 174.2 hours per week, or 24.9 hours per day, in 50-degree water. It seemed unlikely that Ray spent more than 24 hours per day in water. In fact, he didn't even spend 2 hours per day swimming in or consuming 50-degree water. Something else needed to be happening. It could have been the other thermic loads he experimented with, cold walks, sleeping without sheets, etc. Digging deeper still, I now believe that the something else, the X factor, involves two players you'll hear much more about in the next few years, BAT and adiponectin. Adiponectin is a cool little hormone secreted by fat cells that can both increase the oxidation, burning, of fatty acids in mitochondria, and increase uptake of glucose by muscle tissue. I believe adiponectin is largely to thank for Ray's muscle gain. Speculation notwithstanding, the research is in its early stages, so I'll reserve adiponectin as an intellectual dessert for the geeks among you. My forays into its potential can be found in the online resources. BAT and my related torture experiments, on the other hand, are worth taking a closer look at. If the science gets too dense and you want the index card version, be careful. Skip to Ice Age Revisited, 4 places to start, at the end of this chapter. I won't be offended. If you're interested in learning to leverage fat-burning fat, on the other hand, keep listening. In 1999, amusingly, most researchers firmly believed that BAT, while abundant in infants, was non-existent, or, best case, negligible in adults. I was in the midst of my Guantanamo Bay baths at this time, and these conclusions did not square with my experience. It wasn't until years later that better tools, most notably positron emission topography, PET, became more widespread and were used to demonstrate that BAT is most certainly present in adults, particularly in the neck and upper chest areas. That explains why the ice packs on my neck and upper trapezius worked. In the May 2009 issue of Obesity Review, a paper was published titled, "Have We Entered the BAT Renaissance?" I'd say the answer is yes. The abstract concludes, "These recent discoveries should revamp our effort to target the molecular development of brown adipogenesis in the treatment of obesity." Let's start with cold. It isn't fancy, but it works damn well. If we combine the research with preliminary data, there are four simple options you can experiment with for fat loss. Place an ice pack on the back of the neck or upper trapezius area for 20 to 30 minutes, preferably in the evening when insulin sensitivity is lowest. I place a towel on the couch while writing or watching a movie and simply lean back against the ice pack. Consume, as Ray did, at least 500 milliliters of ice water on an empty stomach immediately upon waking. In at least two studies, this water consumption has been shown to increase resting metabolic rate 24 to 30%, peaking at 40 to 60 minutes post-consumption, though one study demonstrated a lower effect of 4.5%. Eat breakfast 20 to 30 minutes later, a la the slow-carb diet. Take 5 to 10 minute cold showers before breakfast and or before bed. Use hot water for 1 to 2 minutes over the entire body, then step out of water range and apply shampoo and soap to your hair and face. Turn the water to pure cold and rinse your head and face alone. Then turn around and back into the water, focusing the water on your lower neck and upper back. Maintain this position for 1 to 3 minutes as you acclimate and apply soap to all the necessary regions. Then, turn around and rinse normally. Expect this to wake you up like a foghorn. If you're impatient and can tolerate more, take 20-minute baths that induce shivering within 5 minutes. From geek to freak. How to gain 34 pounds in 28 days. On July 6, 65-year-old John's biceps measured 14.5 inches in circumference. 6 weeks later, his biceps measured a full 3/4 inch larger at 15 1/4 inches. How did he do it? He reduced his workouts from 3 per week to 2 per week. It was all planned, progressive reduction. You see, it turns out that most of the conventional wisdom about muscular growth is just dead wrong. From a training standpoint, there were 4 basic principles that made it happen, all of which will be expanded upon soon. 1. Perform 1 set to failure for each exercise. Follow Arthur Jones's general recommendation of 1 set to failure, i.e., reaching the point where you can no longer move the weight, for 80 to 120 seconds of total time under tension per exercise. Take at least 3 minutes of rest between exercises. 2. Use a 5-to-5 rep cadence. Perform every repetition with a 5-to-5 cadence, 5 seconds up, 5 seconds down, to eliminate momentum and ensure constant load. 3. Focus on 2-to-10 exercises per workout, no more. Focus on 2-to-10 exercises per workout, including at least 1 multi-joint exercise for pressing, pulling, and leg movements. The sequence I've used can be found at 4hourbody.com/exercises. 4. Increase recovery time along with size. This is described at length in the next chapter, Occam's Protocol. This is the exact protocol I suggest you follow. Occam's Protocol 1. A minimalist approach to mass. The goal of this chapter is to reduce everything to the absolute minimum. Before we get started, though, we need to discuss the bike shed effect. To illustrate this phenomenon, let's compare a conversation about building a nuclear power plant with building a bike shed. Most people rightly assume that they know nothing about something as complex as a nuclear power plant, and so won't voice an opinion. Most people wrongly assume, however, that they know something about building a bike shed and will argue until the cows come home about every detail down to paint color. Everyone you meet, every male at least, will have a strong opinion about how you should train and eat. For the next 2 to 4 weeks, I suggest cultivating selective ignorance and refusing to have bike shed discussions with others. Friends, foes, colleagues, and well-intentioned folks of all stripes will offer distracting and counterproductive additions and alternatives. Nod, thank them kindly, and step away to do what you've planned. Nothing more and nothing different. Complicate to profit, minimize to grow. There is one default dictum in the diet and exercise industries. Complicate to profit. The objective of the minimalist routine in this chapter is not to make you a professional athlete, not to make you as strong as possible, though strength will increase and the gains will surpass most protocols. Here is our singular objective: to apply the MED necessary to trigger muscular growth mechanisms and then channel food preferentially into muscle tissue during overfeeding. There is one condition. We must do both as safely as possible. The safety issue is particularly important to understand when considering exercises. Don't get me wrong, all movements are safe when performed properly. This includes backflips on one leg, breakdancing, head spins, and the much vaunted snatch. The problem with such movements and dozens of others is that a minor technical mistake can cause serious, often permanent injuries. These injuries are underreported because, one, those affected don't want to be ostracized from communities that view the moves as gospel. And two, cognitive dissonance prevents them from admitting that a move is inherently high risk if they've advocated it for a long time. So what is used instead to explain the injury? I, he, she just didn't do it right. There is underreporting of diet failures, raw food as one example, for similar reasons. In fairness, can you do snatches safely? Sure. But if there are safer substitutes that provide 80% or more of the benefits, I will suggest those substitutes instead. In more than 15 years of resistance training, I've never been injured following the protocols I will describe here. I suggest adopting one rule of Dr. Ken Leistner, an NFL strength consultant I had the painful pleasure of training with in 1996. The goal of strength training is to reduce injury potential first and to increase performance second. Occam's protocol is a variation of the consolidation routine used by the late Mike Mentzer, who won the heavyweight class of the Mr. Olympia competition in 1979. It is possible to get huge with less than 30 minutes of gym time per week. In the PDF, you'll see that the Occam's protocol A and B workouts are alternated, whether you choose the machine or free weight option. The exercises should be performed for one set each and no more. The objective is to fail, to reach the point where you can no longer move the weight at 7 or more repetitions at a 5-to-5 cadence, 5 seconds up and 5 seconds down. The leg press is to be performed for 10 or more repetitions at the same cadence. The only exceptions to the cadence rule are the abdominal exercises and the kettlebell swing, which are also described in the PDF. Find them and give them a look. The mechanisms of growth we want to stimulate are both local, muscular, neural, and systemic, hormonal. The longer time under tension, TUT, for the lower body will elicit a greater full body growth hormone response while also stimulating the formation of new capillaries, which will improve nutrient delivery. As I've said, consult the PDF for a detailed look at the A and B workouts. For now, here are some rules to live by. If you complete the minimal target number of reps for all exercises, excluding abs and kettlebell swing, increase the weight the next workout at least 10 pounds for that exercise. If the additional 10 pounds feels easy after 2 to 3 reps, stop, wait 5 minutes, increase the weight an additional 5 to 10 pounds, then do your single set to failure. Do not just drop the weight when you hit failure. Attempt to move it. millimeter by millimeter, and then hold it at the limit for 5 seconds. Only after that should you slowly, take 5 to 10 seconds, lower the weight. The biggest mistake novice trainees make is underestimated the severity of complete failure. Failure is not dropping the weight after your last moderately strenuous rep. It is pushing like you have a gun to your head. To quote the ever-poetic Arthur Jones, if you've never vomited doing a set of barbell curls, then you've never experienced outright hard work. If you feel like you could do another set of the same exercise a minute later, you didn't reach failure as we are defining it. Remember that the last repetition, the point of failure, is the one that matters. The rest of the repetitions are just a warm-up for that moment. Do not pause at the top or bottom of any movements, except the bench press, as noted. And take 3 minutes of rest between all exercises. Time 3 minutes exactly with a wall clock or a stopwatch. Keep rest periods standardized so you don't mistake rest changes for strength changes. The weight and repetitions used will change as you progress, but all other variables need to be identical from one workout to the next. Rep speed, exercise form, and rest intervals. This is a laboratory experiment. To accurately gauge progress and tweak as needed, you must ensure that you control your variables. That's it. The temptation to add exercises will be enormous. Don't do it. If anything, if you've never been able to gain mass, you might choose to do less. The frequency of the A and B Occam workouts is based on a simple premise. You must increase recovery time along with size. You will exercise less frequently as you increase strength and size, as you can often increase muscle mass well over 100% before reaching a genetic ceiling. But your recovery abilities might only improve 20 to 30% through enzymatic and immune system upregulation, increased plasma glutamine production, etc. Put in simple terms, it takes non-growing repair systems longer to repair a 20-pound muscle than its 10-pound predecessor. The bigger and stronger you get, the less often you will go to the gym. Getting started. Step 1. Take at least 7 days off of all training that causes significant muscular damage. No bodyweight resistance training or weight training allowed. Step 2. Begin Occam's protocol with 2 days between A and B workouts. After two of both the A and B workouts, increase the rest days between workouts to 3 days. As soon as you have a workout where more than one exercise is stalled, but not before, increase to 4 days between workouts. Continue adding rest as needed to resolve plateaus until you hit your target weight or end your bulking cycle. Important caveat. This spacing assumes you are consuming enough food to support rapid growth. Of the trainees who fail to gain significant muscular weight, significant equals at least 2.5 pounds per week, on Occam's protocol, 95% plus of them fail due to insufficient caloric nutrient intake. The remaining 5% or less have nutrient absorption issues such as leaky gut syndrome, impaired stomach acid production, excessive fat excretion, insufficient bile, etc., or other conditions requiring medical attention before the protocol can do its job. I've encountered only one such clinical case in the 5% group. He was 124 pounds at 6'1", and even when he attempted to gain weight by eating bag after bag of donuts in 24-hour periods, he could not gain a single pound. Don't assume you are in this unlikely minority. The most common problem is insufficient food intake. That leads us to the real challenge of Occam's protocol. Eating. And here, once again, you'll have to consult the PDF file for details on Occam's feeding. While you're there, look at Occam's prescriptions, too. I've also included another discussion there, Occam's Protocol 2, which addresses finer points, common questions, and criticisms. Improving sex. The 15-minute female orgasm. Part Un. 9 p.m., Asha Thai Restaurant, San Francisco. My Thai food hovered between my plate and my mouth, broccoli dangling off the fork. Then it fell. I was focusing more on the conversation than the eating. For almost all women, the most sensitive part of the clit will be the upper left-hand quadrant from their perspective, around 1 o'clock from the man's perspective. Tallulah Sulis, a specialist in female ejaculation, paused to take a sip of water and raise her eyes to meet mine. Sometime, you should really try and meet Nicole Dadone. Tallulah was an old friend, and now my first orgasm consigliere. I wrote the name down on a note, and we meandered from our love life catch-up to other topics. 2 hours later, we settled the bill and I walked her to her car. As we ambled over the crosswalk, I turned to her and joked, "Now all I need to do is find a beautiful single girl who's never had an orgasm." It was a funny ending to an entertaining night. Little did I realize how important the note in my pocket would soon become. Exactly 24 hours later, serendipity entered stage left. I was enjoying French food and a bottle of Bordeaux with a female 25-year-old yoga instructor new to San Francisco, fresh from the Midwest. Talk drifted to the single scene and then to her culture shock in places like the Castro, where drag queens and transsexuals have dinner next to dot-com millionaires. Nothing is taboo, and she was just getting acclimated. SF is, after all, the world's capital city of sexual exploration. Several glasses further into the evening, she casually admitted that she'd never experienced an orgasm. How we got to that topic, I don't remember, but I looked around to see if God was playing a trick on me. Never won the Powerball lottery, but I assume the winners felt something like I felt then. My daydream was interrupted when her follow-up comment hit me like a ton of bricks. It's fine, though. I've realized that sex just isn't that important. Time out. What? I blurted a little too loudly. This gorgeous woman, in her prime, let's call her Giselle, had compartmentalized sex as an unimportant and uninteresting activity. As the wine flowed and we continued to talk, it became clear that this rationalization was a direct product of her inability to fully enjoy it. And so it came to be that I made her a drunken promise. I would fix her inability to orgasm. Not that night, not necessarily through me, but somehow. In retrospect, it was a foolish and overconfident promise. But with alcohol-induced optimism on my side, I viewed it as a watershed moment, an opportunity to harness my OCD for the greater good. Most men assume they kinda sorta understand female anatomy, but the upper left quadrant at 1 o'clock? That was a new one. Tallulah had given me a glimpse of a different world altogether. Later that evening, somewhere between Wikipedia and Pornhub, I realized Giselle wasn't alone. Sex researcher Sherry Haidt had long ago concluded that 70% of U.S. women couldn't experience orgasm from intercourse, and Alfred Kinsey's data suggested that up to 50% of U.S. women weren't able to achieve orgasm at all. My quest for the elusive female orgasm had begun. The outcome, 4 weeks later, was better than I ever could have imagined. I was able to facilitate orgasms, the word facilitate will be explained later, in every woman who acted as a test subject. The results? Those who'd never experienced manual-only orgasm were able to do so, and those who'd never experienced penetration-only orgasm were also able to do so. The success rate was 100%. Here is what I learned. The morning after wine with Giselle, I wrote down a number of questions that seemed like good starting points. Several of them related to extending male endurance, if that were to prove a limiting factor. I figured I might need to train men to become energizer bunnies. Some of the inbuilt assumptions reflected in the wording turned out to be totally wrong, but here are my original questions. How do you tweak the most common sexual positions to make it more likely that the woman will orgasm? How can you reduce the refractory periods, the erection impossible period after ejaculation, for men? This would allow more sessions per night. Is it possible for men to have multiple orgasms without ejaculating? How do you keep it, the hoo-ha that is, from stretching out over time? A female friend insisted I throw this one in. Once I had questions, I needed some answers. For that, I would need two things: experts and lots of practice. First things first, experts. There is no shortage of how-to sexual information, from Qigong penis, competes with the Iron Penis Kung Fu School, to orgasm training on elaborate vibrator saddle machines like the Sibian. It's a paradox of choice problem. Considering the options, I quickly began to think that I might be reenacting The Snow Leopard by Peter Mathiasen. In 1973, Peter traveled with zoologist George Schaller 250 miles into Himalayan no man's land in search of the near-mythical snow leopard. Not to be a spoiler, but he didn't find a goddamn cat. He saw rare mountain sheep, foxes, wolves, even signs of the snow leopard itself, but it was never found. Fortunately, Peter's experience led to a Buddhist-like search for meaning and a beautiful classic in nature writing. I doubted I could pull the same beauty out of Iron Penis Kung Fu. My quest was all or nothing, and it needed a happy ending. I had no choice but to narrow down the field, to find someone who'd already tried everything. There was only one place to look. Nina Hartley became a registered nurse in 1985 after graduating magna cum laude from San Francisco State University. She also started stripping her sophomore year, which led to experimenting in adult films. It was not a college phase. Nina has since starred or featured in more than 650 porn films and is one of the most recognized and respected names in the business. Lexington Steele, the only person ever to win the AVN, the Oscars of Porn, Male Performer of the Year Award, three times, has publicly stated without hesitation that the single greatest sexual experience of his life was with Nina. My friend Sylvester Norwood later told me the same thing, but WTF? His confession confused me, not because I doubted Nina had the skills, but how the hell did Sylvester enter the picture? The same well-behaved Jewish boy too shy to talk to girls? Shimmer and fade to reenactment. Straight out of Ripley's Believe It or Not, Sylvester's mom attended a group dinner in Berkeley, California that Nina also happened to be attending, and the two ended up seated next to one another. Mrs. Norwood came home and said to then 22-year-old Sylvester, "Guess who I was at dinner with? A famous porn star, Nina Hartley. Have you ever heard of her?" Sylvester nearly choked. In his secret double life, he had a huge collection of videos featuring Nina, his personal snow leopard. "Mom, I have to meet her. If I never do anything again in this life, I must meet Nina Hartley." 3 days of insistent begging and nagging later, Sylvester's mom raised a hand and picked up the phone. "Hi, Nina, it's Mrs. Norwood. I had such a wonderful time meeting you at the party. Listen, I have a question for you. Do you ever make love to younger men?" Nina's answer? "Why, yes, I love breaking in younger men, but only once." And so it happened. Summary, coolest mom ever. A decade later, Sylvester is still friends with Nina, and he introduced us via email. The 2-hour phone call that followed was a master's degree in all things sexual, but the most actionable highlights related to 1, the single most important precondition for female orgasm, and 2, technical modifications of positions. The precondition. Women need to step up to the starting line first. No man can give you an orgasm. He can only help you do it yourself. This is why I used the word facilitate earlier. First and foremost, Nina emphasized, a woman has to be comfortable masturbating. If she doesn't masturbate regularly, she'll be more trouble, baggage-wise, than it's worth. Unless you get off on being the fixer. She has to at least come up to the starting line and be comfortable conversing with her own orgasmic potential. For years, Nina herself was too embarrassed to show her O-face, her face during orgasm, to partners, thinking it was ugly or unattractive, not realizing that men go nuts for it. The woman needs to know how beautiful and exciting she is in that state. Truer words were never spoken. To those women who don't masturbate, Nina recommends starting in small increments, 5 minutes a night before bed or immediately after waking up, and listening to self-talk. What is your head telling you? Unwarranted guilt and shame? Both will pass with practice, and you must be comfortable solo before it's possible with someone else. 30 minutes after the interview with Nina, I called Giselle. The verdict? She never masturbated. She was the eldest daughter in her family, an unexpected recurring theme I found among non-orgasmic women and had been raised Catholic. Her mother used scare tactics with religious overtones, repeating phrases like, "I hope your decision to abstain includes remembering your faith." This fueled a feeling of obligation to be a role model for her younger sisters, and the end product of it all was predictable. She disallowed herself pleasure, viewing it as a hazard, and was now well on the path to asexuality. Step 1. I gave Giselle, who agreed to play along, the book Sex for One by Betty Dodson, along with a homework assignment to masturbate prior to bed for 5 minutes each night. Then I crossed my fingers. The next few weeks would show if her discomfort and disinterest could be fixed through simple conditioning. I hoped 5 minutes of nightly homework would be enough. The positions. Precision and pressure. Nina emphasized two slight modifications to most positions, changing the angle of penetration so that the head of the penis makes more contact with the female G-spot, which is generally about a quarter in size and 1 to 2 inches inside the vagina on the top side. If the male inserts an index finger up to the second knuckle, palm up, and makes a come-hither motion, the fingertip should touch a sponge-like tissue, or be within an inch of it. This is the G-spot. Changing the pressure of the position so that the man's pelvic bone is in direct contact with the clitoris. The descriptions you're about to hear are based on Nina's suggestions as well as my research testing. The three positions described were chosen because the woman need not necessarily stimulate herself, as would be the case in doggy style. Missionary position versus improved angle missionary. The woman's hips should be elevated on a pillow to tilt her hips toward her head. Nina suggests buckwheat hull pillows, which are firm and, unlike foam or feather pillows, don't collapse. I fell in love with them in Japan, as the hulls conform to your head and neck to offer the perfect night's sleep. They conform equally well to female buttocks, while keeping them a perfect 6 or so inches off the bed. The man then moves his hips as close as possible to the woman's hips while keeping his heels under his buttocks. He should be sitting Japanese style, sitting on heels with knees spread as wide as is comfortable. The lower he keeps his hips, the better the angle to hit the G-spot. Experiment with different depths of penetration. Using a rhythm of 9 shorter half-length penetrations with 1 long is particularly effective. Use the bottom of the opening of her vagina as a fulcrum for the penis, which will act as a lever. The woman should test A, pulling her knees toward her chest to tilt her hips toward her, and B, placing her feet flat on the bed to elevate her hips. One will usually feel awesome, while the other will feel awkward. Note for the big gents on long strokes. If your penis is apt to hit her cervix in this position, which is not pleasant for women, open up one hip, as they say in the adult film business. Putting her belly button at 12 noon, aim your penis at 10 or 2 o'clock. This works for all positions where deep penetration is possible. Doggy style, knees on shoulders, etc. Pain isn't sexy unless the woman tells you it is. Improved pressure missionary. To accomplish this position, the male must shift his weight forward a few inches. First, he must straighten his legs. Bringing them closer together makes this easier, so the knees are off of the bed. Then he'll support more weight on her pelvis, the entire purpose, and his arms. This changes the angle of penetration so that the focal point of friction is no longer the head of the penis against the vaginal wall, but rather the man's pelvic bone on the woman's clitoris. This kills 2 birds with 1 stone. The man can last far longer, and the woman receives direct clitoral stimulation. This modification was recommended by Nina, but she is not alone. Tallulah was emphatic. The number one move I would offer to men is the targeted pelvic grinding in this position, either moving the hips in small circles or slowly side to side. I later found bracing the abdomen muscles, even extending them a bit, and rocking the hips back and forth in a short 1 to 2 inch motion to be most effective. Imagine that. From just below your navel to the base of your penis, you are connected to the woman. Never lose contact with the clitoris. If you do this right, expect to feel like you did 1,000 sit-ups the next day. Just remember what one friend said to me as I ground the gears of my car on a steep hill in San Francisco. If you can't find it, grind it. Bad advice in cars, good advice in girls. Conventional cowgirl position versus improved pressure cowgirl position. Improved pressure cowgirl puts the woman on top and recreates the same penile position as in improved pressure missionary. The man should not be flat on his back, nor should he be sitting straight up. He should be leaning back about 20 degrees. This can be accomplished with pillows on a bed or, ideally, on an armless chair with a back that the woman can hold on to. The advantage of this position is simple. The woman can control the motion. Professor Nina offers the following advice for all intercourse. When in doubt, you supply the pressure and she provides the movement. The male can hold a vibrator to the clit in this position, but I opted not to because of the risk of distraction on both sides. As Nina-san saith, a vibrator can be a girl's best friend, or it can be as annoying as a mosquito. I could always bring in the heavy artillery after the fact, but I wanted to be ready for empty-handed encounters. I wanted to deconstruct the orgasm and create it at will without any tools. That's when the note in my pocket became the keys to the kingdom. The 15-Minute Female Orgasm. Part 2. Stupid Animals. Here's a composite scene that repeats itself millions of times per night around the world. Man finally gets to go downtown and fumbles to get his hand where it counts. Man starts random up and down or circular motion, hoping to God he can hit the spot and not act surprised. Woman moans and man thinks he's doing well. Woman stops moaning. Man shifts technique or goes into hyperdrive, and woman asks him to slow down a bit. Man slows down, and exactly 5 seconds of mild positive response later, nothing. Man feels like a dog trying to open a door with no thumbs. If he's out to beat the clitoris, dead or alive, as most men are, woman gently stops his increasingly erratic attack after 10 minutes. Best case, they move on to something the man can understand, like penis and vagina. He's a stupid animal, folks. Have mercy. The clitoris looks something like an Imperial Guard from Star Wars. It's also much larger than most people realize. The clitoral glands, what most refer to as the clit, extends back and splits into an upside-down V. Those legs, the clitoral crura, are concealed behind the labia minora. Some researchers believe that G-spot stimulation is actually stimulation of the crura, and that all orgasms originate from stimulation of the clitoris. Some researchers, mostly male, disagree. It's not hard to understand why men pretend it doesn't exist. If it doesn't exist, or if it's unpredictable, men can write it off as a female problem. Leaving dinner with Tallulah, I became fixated on the idea of a hypersensitive upper left quadrant on the clitoris. Could it really be that straightforward? I walked home from the restaurant that evening and jumped on my laptop to begin researching the one method Tallulah had mentioned by name, the doing method. 72 hours later, I tested the upper quadrant technique on a willing test subject who'd never experienced an orgasm from finger-only stimulation. 2 strong peaking orgasms and an extended 15-minute continuous orgasm followed. I was shocked, speechless. It worked on the first shot. Now I just needed to make the technique bulletproof. To do that, I would need to meet not just a master, but the master. Luckily, I had her name in my pocket on a little scrap of paper. Nicole Dadone. Origins, Moore University. Lafayette Morehouse was established by Dr. Victor Barranco in 1968 on Person Lane in Lafayette, California. Operating as Moore University from 1977 to 1997, it was a commune founded on the ideal of responsible hedonism. The residents painted the buildings and automobiles on the property purple, and their newsletter explained the rationale. We tell people that all the houses here are purple so that there is no mistake that one has changed realities should they wander onto our property. If people missed the purple, there were other warning signs for wanderers. In the 1960s, Barranco and his wife Susie began researching how to improve their sex lives. Both believe that the amount of sensual pleasure available to an individual far exceeded the expectations commonly held in society. In 1976, after more than a decade of experimentation, they blew the floodgates open by giving the first public demonstration of female orgasm. It lasted 3 hours. That's a genital dances with wolves. The female student who demonstrated the orgasm, Diana, recalled the result it had on the wall-to-wall audience. When that demonstration was over, people ran to every available space on the property so that they could get off too. Get the women off. It was really the women. Not surprisingly, students flocked to Morehouse. Two students of the Morehouse methods for extending orgasm were Doctors Steve and Vera Badansky, founders of the doing method I had taken for a test drive. Another was Ray Vetterleem, who took his first class at Morehouse in 1968, 8 years before the public demo. He earned its highest private qualification in 1989 and has been refining his methods ever since, for more than 40 years. Less than a month after dinner with Tallulah, I was witnessing some of Ray's findings firsthand. "You want to use about 2 sheets of paper worth of pressure," explained my chaperone, Iko, who had organized the visit and was sitting to my right. "Roger that. Go by how it feels, not by how it sounds." I scribbled down notes as 4 one-taste practitioners, 2 seated next to me and 2 on the floor, demonstrated and explained the fine-tuning I needed. One Taste was founded in 2001 by Nicole Dedone, a student of Morehouse and Vetterleem, to give women a clean and brightly lit place to learn about orgasm from another woman. I'd met with Nicole the afternoon before, and our conversation had started at neuroscience and ended with me recounting my trial run of the doing method. One thing was clear to her. There was much room for improvement. Now I found myself at One Taste's coaching location in the SoMa district of San Francisco. Their expansion in both New York City and California has been funded largely by Reese Jones, who sold his software company Netopia to Motorola for $208 million. The slow sex movement thus began, and Nicole was its default leader. "So can I ask exactly where you are touching the clit now? It's still in upward motion?" I was positioned on an office chair with my elbows on my knees, looking down at the woman's vulva from about 5 feet away, where she and her male partner were positioned on pillows and throw rugs. "You can get closer," said Iko. "Sure, get as close as you need to," added the woman on her back. So I did. I watched from a distance of about 2 feet, sometimes closer, as the woman's entire physiology changed over 15 minutes, asking questions and watching the man's technique. Then it was my turn. "Are you ready?" Iko asked. Sure. Personal clitoral coaching was the last thing I thought I'd be doing at 10 a.m. on a weekday, but I already had 4 pages of detailed notes. If I didn't put theory into practice now, none of it would make sense later. So on went the latex gloves. My research partner arrived, and we repeated what I'd just seen. The two coaches who'd been sitting next to me earlier were now seated in front of me, kneeling about 3 feet from the woman's clitoris. They reached in occasionally to correct my hand position and offered intermittent suggestions. "Ensure your forearm is parallel to her body." Or encouragement. "Good stroke." It was like playing for the coolest little league team in the world. "Go, Timmy, go!" My partner experienced all of the involuntary muscle contraction I had hoped for, and the group coaching, though a little weird, wasn't uncomfortable in the least. Iko asked me if I had any feedback after the session ended. I did. This should be required education for every man on the planet. The practice and how-to, the 15-minute orgasm. I believe the 2 principal reasons the One Taste method works so well is that, 1, it is presented as a goalless practice, and 2, it decouples orgasm from sex. Kissing, fondling, disrobing, whispering, and requesting are all fun and wonderful parts of sex. Unfortunately, Multitasking these actions often splits the attention a woman needs to reach orgasm. We'll develop singular focus through isolated practice, and it can later be brought into sex. The technique requires 15 minutes of 100% concentration on approximately 3 square millimeters of contact. Nothing more. Test this and practice it. The payoff can alter your sexual experiences forever. I'll explain this from the standpoint of a man, as that's what I am. 1. Explain to your partner that this is a goalless practice. This is 100% critical. There is no objective, just a focus on a single point of contact. The phrasing should emphasize this and remove all expectations and pressure. I'm going to touch you for 15 minutes. You don't need to do anything, and you don't have to do anything afterward. There is nowhere to get to, nothing to make happen. Just focus on the single point of contact. It's an exercise. The only focus should be on the short stroke, one stroke, one stroke, just as the emphasis would be on the breath, one breath, one breath, in most forms of meditation. View it as an exercise in mindful awareness. There is no goal. 2. Get into position. First, the woman disrobes from the waist down and lies on her back using a pillow for neck support. Her legs are bent and spread, feet together in butterfly position. If this makes her hips uncomfortable on one or both sides, pillows can be put underneath her knees. Based on the premise that it is easier to achieve the proper angle of contact with the left hand, the man should sit to her right side on top of at least two pillows and straddle his bent left leg perpendicularly across her torso, foot flat on the opposite side. Add as many pillows as necessary to relieve any pressure from his left leg on her abdomen. Too many is better than too few. His right leg is straight or relaxed in butterfly position. Despite the left-handed positioning, which is ideal, I'm right-handed and impatient with poor fine motor control. I had more consistent luck sitting on the woman's left side and using my right hand. If you choose to do the same, it's important to tilt your right wrist toward you slightly, as if you were looking at a watch. This creates a better finger angle. 3. Set the timer for 15 minutes, find the upper quadrant point of greatest sensation, and stroke. Limit the session to exactly 15 minutes. I used a kitchen timer. This removes performance pressure and creates a safe start and end container for the woman. Look at it as you would a yoga routine or deep breathing sequence. It is an exercise in focused repetition, not a goal. Finding the upper quadrant and anchoring. Separate the labia. Retract the clitoral hood upward with the heel of the palm. Anchor the clitoris with the thumb. Put your other hand under her buttocks, two fingers under each cheek, with the thumb resting on, not in, the base of the entrance to the vagina, ring of introitus. This will act as an anchor and help the woman to relax. Imagine you are looking directly at the clitoris from between her legs, with the top of the clitoris as 12 o'clock on a clock face. Find 1 p.m., ideally a small indentation or pocket between the hood and her clitoris, with your index finger, and begin stroking using the lightest touch possible and only 1/16th of an inch or so of movement. The tip of the finger is better than the pad, so cut your nails beforehand. Nicole emphasizes the start. If I can suggest one thing to the guys, take the time to find the spot. Once you find it, she won't be able to take more than a very light touch, like brushing satin against her skin. Stroke like a metronome at a constant speed for periods of 2 to 3 minutes, but feel free to change speed between periods. Ground at the end. Once the 15 minutes have elapsed, grounding is performed to ease the woman out of the experience. Though there are sophisticated options for this closing portion, it will suffice for novice males to apply strong pressure down on the pubic bone and up toward the woman's head, using overlapping hands. Let her dictate the pressure. Most women, in my experience, find the strongest possible pressure the most pleasurable for ending a session. I initially thought this closing portion was a waste of time. Grounding? It sounded like a bunch of New Age nonsense. Now I believe that grounding is most important, not as some type of energetic witchcraft, but rather for closure. It consummates a complete experience with beginning, setup, middle, stroking, and end, grounding. This format gives both parties a sense of accomplishment that artfully helps avoid fixation on a full-blown orgasm as closure. Remember that it's the goalless nature of the practice that allows the relaxation that produces the orgasm. This guaranteed outcome, grounding, is smart and, I now believe, critical to include. Based on coaching and practice, here are some helpful guidelines. Light contact. Remember, 2 pages of paper depth of pressure. No more. It takes a lot of strength and concentration to stroke lightly. It isn't building toward anything. Keep the practice goalless and remember the intention. Singularly focused repetition for 15 minutes. Consider using a blindfold or airline eye mask on the woman. I found it makes them less self-conscious and increases tactile sensitivity. Have her turn off the show. She doesn't need to please you. Make this clear. She doesn't need to moan and groan. It's about subtle sensation and nothing extra. Make it fun and even call it an experiment. Serious equals tension. Keep it light. Related to this, no idle chatter. Some women will talk to distract themselves and prevent orgasm or to prevent facial expressions of pleasure. This is an exercise in overcoming embarrassment, so the talking crutch should be removed. Using an eye mask helps minimize the talking impulse. Reinforce relaxation gently if the woman seems tense or anxious. I noticed you're tense. Try and relax a little bit. If she's experiencing strong contractions, which will clearly exhaust her before 15 minutes are up, encourage her to breathe and push out slightly as if she were going to pee. She won't pee, and it will help her extend the plateau and minimizing fatigue. Most common mistakes. Being goal-oriented. This includes women who will ask for insertion or penetration. Do not oblige them until the 15 minutes are up. Sex is fine afterward, but not until the session is finished. Don't give in. She might beg in the moment, but will thank you later for holding off. Once you've completed 5 15-minute sessions without caving in, feel free to break the rules and go nuts before 15 minutes are up, but not until you've followed the rules for 5 sessions. Asking non-winning questions of the woman almost guarantees lying, such as, does it feel good, or are you enjoying this? Asking questions is encouraged, but use directional questions instead. Would you like a lighter or stronger stroke? More to your left or right? Higher or lower? Using too much pressure. I consciously focused on a light touch when practicing the doing method for the first time, and I assumed it was light enough. It wasn't. I was using at least 3 times too much pressure. Imagine tickling a sleeping friend's nose just enough to make him scratch his own nose, but not enough to wake up. Once you're comfortable with a basic practice, 5 stroke-only sessions, but not before, try these. Insert the middle finger of the non-stroking hand, palm up, and use a come-hither motion to stimulate the G-spot. After 5 minutes, add in the index finger for a total of 2 fingers, and continue the come-hither motion. Place a buckwheat pillow under her hips for the same angle as the improved angle missionary, and use your left thumb to anchor the clitoris while you perform cunnilingus at the 1 o'clock upper quadrant of the clit. Do this as lightly as you would perform the stroke for at least 5 minutes, without finger insertion, and then add a finger. Build a strong neck so she doesn't pop your head off. So did Giselle get to the finish line? Yes. And she ended up getting much more. It started with her masturbation homework assignments. I'm similar to my closest friends in most ways, so I'd assume this would also be the case. It wasn't. I was the only one who didn't masturbate. Once she started talking to her girlfriends about it, the entire subject became less taboo and became normal. Suddenly, sex wasn't something to be avoided. Now, it was something fun to talk about over a glass of wine. She'd also realized that she'd been suppressing a critical part of herself, and that without a developed sexuality, she wasn't a fully developed person.